Vishnu Tri Adishvare Chitam Dharayat Kalavikrahe Sa Itsitvam Avapnoti Kshetrakya Kshetrakoranam. Translation: one who concentrates his consciousness in Vishnu, the Supersoul, the Prime Mover and Supreme Lord of the external energy consisting of three modes, obtains the mystic perfection of controlling other conditioned souls, their material bodies and bodily designations. Purport: one should remember that mystic perfection never enables a living entity to challenge the supremacy of the personality of Godhead. In fact, one cannot obtain such perfections without the mercy of the Lord. Thus one's controlling power can never disturb the plan of Krishna. One is allowed to exhibit mystic control only within the confines of the law of God. And even a great yogi who transgresses the laws of God by his so-called mystic opulences can be severely punished, as revealed by the story of Durvasa Muni cursing Maharaj Ambarish. So in this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, we are reminded of where our spiritual prowess comes from, and that we must never abuse it or misuse it. It is only natural that as a transcendentalist, any transcendentalist, it means a yogi, a jnani, or a bhakta, these are the three classes of transcendentalists, it's only natural that as they advance in their chosen path, they begin to manifest certain spiritual qualities, certain spiritual characteristics, and to some degree, spiritual powers. Even devotees have a certain spiritual power. You could say it's a spiritual power to be able to control the mind and the senses. It's not by any mechanical means or material means that one is able to control the restless mind or the demanding senses. It's only by spiritual strength that one is able to do so. So even as devotees, we have certain spiritual opulences, certain spiritual strengths. We often quote the verse, Titikshava, the verse. Titikshava gurnika shuridam sarvadehinam achata shatava shanta shatava shadbhushana. That by practicing bhakti yoga or devotional service, one naturally manifests all wonderful spiritual qualities like Tikshava, Kurnika, Shuridam, Sharvadehinam, Ashuta, Shutava, Shanta. Devotee becomes tolerant, Kurnika, he becomes merciful, he befriends all living entities, he has no enemies. So, and we see even to some degree when we're performing Sankirtan, devotee has a certain influence over the fallen conditioned souls to get them to take up the process themselves, to take a book, to encourage them to come to the temple, to come to the festival. They're not interested in spiritual things at all, but by the influence of a devotee, they take up some interest. So this is some spiritual prowess, and it's far greater than anything material. It's simple logic that spirit is more powerful than matter. This body weighs about, I don't remember, it weighs some kilos. And how heavy is the soul? The soul is described as 1/10,000th the tip of a hair in dimension. So how much weight does if you put the soul on a scale and you put your body on the scale, the body would be much heavier than the soul. Nevertheless, it's the soul that is empowering this mass of matter. It's atomic in size, but it's giving life, as we often say in our public lectures, to this body. So spirit is more powerful than matter. And as one begins to make progress in spiritual life, awakening the slumbering soul, activating the spiritual senses, you could say developing our spiritual body, as one becomes advanced, one begins to cleanse away the lust, the anger, the greed, the false ego, and thus the real beauty of the soul becomes manifest. The power of the soul becomes manifest. We see the spiritual qualities, and they're much powerful than any material qualities we may have. Here in this verse, the mystic yogi is warned to remember from where his prowess is coming, where his mystic powers are coming, and otherwise he may make a mistake. For example, the mystic yogi Durvasa Muni, he had great powers, but he became a little bit proud of those powers, a little bit attached to them, thinking he was in control, and the result was that he offended a great devotee, Maharaj Ambarish. So these spiritual opulences that one manifests, even in the first weeks of devotional service, we have to remember that they are all but a spark of the Lord's splendor. We are at best the parts and parcels of the Lord. He is great and we are very small. We're like the gold ring compared to the gold mine, getting back to basics here. Can we leave that door open? Because it's always opening and closing, opening. It's kind of distracting. So our spiritual prowess is nothing compared to Krishna's. We can be yogis, but he's always Yogeshwara. He's the master of all mystic powers. Our position is always very small. Whatever material or spiritual powers we may gain are only by his grace and meant to be exclusively used in his service. Exclusively. Just like a servant lives in the house of his master. We often give the example of South Africa, where the servants are employed to the point where they actually live in the house. They actually live in the house. It's a custom, a tradition, especially during the apartheid era, but even now, that the black Africans, they would be employed by the elite white people as servants in the house. More often than not, I experienced that they were taken very nice care of by the people who hired them. They were given their own house, a little cottage on the property with their own bathroom and facilities and food and kitchen and so forth. And they were taken nice care of. But they were living in that facility, and in order to remain so, they always knew that whatever they had was by the grace of their employers, and they used everything, and the employers, they were living in the house. Prabhupada said one can live in the palace of the king and enjoy the same opulences, but one has to always remember he's the servant of the king. And if one forgets, then he may be thrown away. So whatever we have, devotee thinks like this, because we're infinitesimal, tiny little sphere of souls, completely dependent upon Krishna for everything material and spiritual. So whatever we have is always, if we get something extraordinary, that's a nice word, extraordinary. There's the word ordinary, and there's extraordinary. If we have something extraordinary, if we have something more than just the basic necessities of life, if we have some money, we have some fame, we have some possessions, we have whatever, it's all by the grace of God. What to speak if we've been blessed spiritually, if we have the holy name, if we have puja to our deities, if we have service to our guru, if we have service to the Sankirtan movement, these are great opulences. This is nothing that just comes by chance. We have been great things have been bestowed upon us. And sometimes due to our covered nature, we tend to forget our great fortune. And we become punar mushtika bhav. We again become the mice You know the story. It's been told thousands of times. If you don't know, just listen to a few recordings of your spiritual master, because all the spiritual masters, they tell the story of Punamushtikubhav, again become a mouse. Or we hear the example is given of Arjuna, who was a great devotee, but the Lord used him several times as an example. He was a very humble Vaishnava, because the Lord put him into Maya so he could speak the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna had that thankless service of being put into the illusion so that the Lord could speak the Gita. And another instance, Arjuna was made humble. He was a great warrior, and he was a friend of Krishna, and because of that he was able to overcome the powerful Kauravas on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And one time after the battle of Kurukshetra, Arjuna was, he had the task of, there was no war going on, so the Kshatriyas, they do routine duties, just like people in the army, you know, there's no war going on. They do routine duties back at the base. Actually, Kshatriyas get a little bit impatient because their duty is to fight for Dharma. They get a little impatient when there's no fighting going on. Just like as Sankirtan devotees, we get a little impatient if there's no preaching. In between tours, we get a little restless. We have our Polish tour, and we have our Australian tour now. We have our different tours, so preachers may get a little bit restless. So Arjuna was between tours, you could say, between battles. There was no battle of Kurukshetra, that was over. So he had the routine duty of accompanying a group of cowherd girls, milkmaids, I always like that, milkmaids, gopis, or milkmaids, through a dangerous forest. And as Arjuna, the powerful warrior who defeated, you know, an army of Kauravas, was going through the forest with these young girls, the party was attacked by some dacoits, some bad guys. And Arjuna drew his bow, and his mighty bow, his Gandiva bow, and he started fighting. But these low-class, so-called low-class dacoits, six or seven of them, who just jumped down from the trees, you know, with their forest dress on and their knives and their clubs, and they defeated Arjuna. He was defeated in a short fight. His hands were tied up, and he was thrown to the ground, and all the cowherd girls were captured by the rogues, by the dacoits, and taken away. Arjuna was left there to wonder, how is it that I could fight in the battle of Kurukshetra and defeat so many powerful warriors, but I can't even protect these milkmaids from these ignoble forest dwellers? And he realized, by grace of the Lord, because Lord is giving intelligence to his devotee, Tesham satara yuktanam vashatam pratipurvikam dadami buddhi yogam tam inamam upayanti te. He realized that he, in fact, had become a little proud of his success in his service to the Lord. He'd become a little overwhelmed. He was so successful, so much admired, but somehow a little glint of pride had entered in there, and then he was humbled. The ways of the Lord are mysterious, how he teaches his devotees. So Arjuna, he got the lesson, because he's the devotee. Of course, it was all a pastime. Again, we should never think that such an intimate, eternal servant of the Lord would ever come under the influence of the material energy. But the Lord uses his devotees to instruct others. He doesn't use the non-devotees, doesn't use the demons to give spiritual instructions necessarily. He uses his devotees. So sometimes devotees are employed. They have the thankless task of being employed in this way to teach a lesson. Now, the other question might be, how could the gopis, these milkmaids who were all really servants of Krishna, devoted followers of the Lord, how could they be touched by these forest dwellers? How could these intimate servants, that the best devotees of the Lord, the gopis of Vrindavan, how could they be touched by lusty, materialistic men who took them away for devious purposes? Well, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in commenting on this particular pastime, mentions that actually these dacoits were all expansions of Lord Krishna. He has many expansions, he has many incarnations. He had expanded himself in this way just to teach Arjuna a lesson. This is how kind he is, his devotee. He will intervene personally to save his devotee. So the girls were not taken away by any dacoits. They were taken away by the Lord himself. So, whatever mystic opulences we may acquire as a result of cleansing the heart of all material qualities and awakening the beauty of the soul, how powerful is the soul? Again, it gives life to this gross body. So powerful, as we often say, more brilliant than 10,000 suns rising simultaneously. The soul. Whenever, as it becomes awakened and we become our real self, we begin to manifest our real self, not this mundane personality with our particular characteristics due to our past karmic activities. Someone has a particular material ability, somebody has another particular material. We know a person because they're like they are. They have certain characteristics. That's not who they really are. Who they really are is that they're a coward boy, or they're a gopi, or they're a desire tree, or they're a cow, or they're something in the spiritual world. They're much more anything but what material qualities they manifest due to their previous karmic activities, their strengths and their weaknesses. Not who they really are. And as it becomes revealed who you really are through the process of cleansing the heart of all misgivings and awakening your spiritual life, your spiritual nature, there's going to be some pretty amazing transformations there. Some pretty amazing devotional service is going to go on. We saw Srila Prabhupada was a completely pure, unalloyed devotee of the Lord, and we saw what he did in this world, how he moved the material energy, how he transplanted Vedic culture from the East into the West. It is a miracle. Prabhupada said one time, one day historians will note how this Hare Krishna movement saved the world in its darkest hour. But whatever qualities are coming, at least I saw personally in Srila Prabhupada, whenever he was glorified, he immediately became very humbled. Immediately. Whenever he would be glorified, he would always hang his head and he would be embarrassed, actually. On the several occasions I saw Prabhupada manifest, you know, ecstatic symptoms, he was really shy, embarrassed, and withdrawn, and didn't want to talk about it. So this is the devotee. He knows from where, he gives credit where credit is due. He gives credit to the Lord's representative, his guru. He gives credit to the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. He gives credit where credit, he knows. His greatness is in he knows how small he is and how dependent upon the Lord he is. Just like if you're a big powerful person in society, but you go for a nature walk and you come to the face of a great mountain, you realize how small you are. You're a big guy, but you come in front of the mountain, it's like, whoa, you feel like humbled. People feel humbled by nature. So that the indication that one is actually self-realized. He knows who Prabhupada says self-realization means to know who you are, who is God, and what is your intimate relationship with God. That is the sum and substance of self-realization. To know who you are, to know who is God, and what is your intimate loving relationship with God. That is in essence the science of self-realization. It's not vague or unclear for us. That is the science of self-realization. So one who's actually self-realized, he won't manifest even an iota of pride. Because he'll have come face to face with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If one is self-realized, if one is a pure devotee, he'll have had darshan with Krishna. And he'll have realized how small he is in comparison to the Lord. So he always manifests humility. This is his greatness. I'm often reminded of this with one of my friends, Fakir Mohan Das. Fakir Mohan Das is a Gaudiya Vaishnava from Orissa. His spiritual master gave him a very interesting name, Fakir, which is actually the name of a Muslim holy man. But for whatever reason it may have been, his guru gave this Gaudiya Vaishnava the name Fakir Mohan. And he's a very wonderful Vaishnava. I hesitate to say that he's my friend, because to say he's my friend means that he's my equal. Actually, he's one of my Shiksha gurus. He's a very advanced Vaishnava. For one Kartik, actually it was longer than Kartik, Madhavananda told me that for 1 year, he lectured on one verse about the glories of the holy name. One verse about the glories of the holy name. Every day for 365, every year, all year, for 365 days. He lectured on one verse, a short verse about the glories. And no, he never repeated himself. You know, so many shlokas. And he's such a friend and a helper of our International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Just so learned, and he knows so many shlokas, and he's so attached to the holy name, and so attached to Guru Seva, and so attached to Krishna. He actually has he sought out, found, and was given the service of Sri Sri Radha Madhava, the original deities of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He searched those deities out in Orissa, because the Aryan culture is rich with our Gaudiya or our Chaitanya heritage, because Gaudiyas actually mean from the north, from Bengal. These are Aryan Vaishnavas, but this very rich. Mahaprabhu spent so much time in Jagannath Puri. Shyamananda Pandit spent so much time preaching there. Very rich. So he's in his late 80s, and he's a genuine Pukka Vaishnava. But whenever he sees me, he offers obeisances from a great distance. I'm thinking, what is this? These are my worshipable. This is a worshipable devotee. But whenever he sees me, or any ISKCON leader, authority, but we have a very sweet relationship. He pays the dandavats. It's so embarrassing. And he comes to my room, he literally crawls into my room. Right, Pallad? He literally crawls into the room, offering pranams and prayers. And it's so, you just have to get down and crawl yourself and meet halfway through the room. He defeats you by his humility. He's a wonderful devotee. And, Bhakir Mohanji. I was fortunate he spent the whole Kartik in Vrindavan this time. And he was always coming, you know, because at my house, everyone was always knocking on the door. You know, so many people come to see me. I come for a break. But whenever I hear a little knock, because he would come sometimes, I'd go peep through the little crack and see who it was. I didn't want to disappoint him, you know. So it's like every few times a week, he'd come and, you know, he's very small. I'd look, I couldn't see anybody. And I'd hear him start laughing. I'd open the door, he'd already be on the ground coming. And I got recorded 20 of his classes, all about the holy name. But his humility is his greatness, because he's realized how great is the Lord. So therefore, you must, in a realized soul, there has to be that humility, having realized the greatness of God. And if you have that understanding, then you can never abuse or misuse whatever opulences Krishna may give you, because he may give you. In the Krishna book, Prabhupada writes, the Lord is always ready to bestow his full opulences upon the fully surrendered soul for the purpose of service. Because it takes great strength, spiritual strength, to preach in this world, which is the only reason we come here or we stay here once we're revived. You need great spiritual strength. So you may get the plumes, you may get the feathers, you may get the whatever. But we have to be like Lord Brahma. He's the head of our sampradaya. He prayed. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a famous prayer. Lord Brahma says, the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead, is always the benefactor of the surrendered souls. His activities are always enacted through his internal potency, Rama, or the goddess of fortune. I pray only to engage in his service in the creation of the material world, and I pray that I not be materially affected by my works, for thus I may be able to give up the false prestige of being the creator. This is a very famous verse in our Sampradaya. It's often quoted by our acharyas to remind us of where we get our strength and how we're meant to use our strength. Of course, accidents do happen, especially to children. Mothers have to always be very, have to always observe their children. I was watching some parents the other day, and they could hardly listen to the class or participate in the kirtan or even the feast. They were just running around, especially the mothers, were running around chasing the kids. The kids are just, they're bursting with energy and they just want to get out in the world, but they don't know what's right or wrong. They don't know what is safe and what is dangerous. You know, babies, they'll put anything in their mouth. So many accidents happen because babies drink some chemical solution or some soap or some whatever. Mothers know. Or they put some object in their mouth and it's too big and they choke, and they put a plastic bag over their head. There's always the warnings on the plastic bags. It's so dangerous to be a kid. You're running around with no brain. So, especially children, if they're susceptible to accidents. You know, by the time you're like 8 or 9, you've got a few scars. I mean, I know I do. I've got scars all over. You know, nothing serious, but the bumps and the bangs and the falls and the little stupid things you do as kids. Everybody here has got some distinctive scar or something. You don't get them so much when you grow older. When you're young, you're susceptible to accidents. So when you're young spiritually, you're also susceptible to accident, especially because, you know, you have the PD disease, the pure devotee disease. You think you're more advanced than you are, so there's no cause for accident for me. So there is chance of an accident. As we often say, even on the royal road to Versailles, right? Versailles. They have a special road to Versailles. Well, now everybody uses it. I think it's an auto route now. Out from Paris, out to Versailles, the palace of Louis the 14th, I think. The 14th? Some Louis. Yeah, he built a palace to Versailles. Beautiful, opulent. But to get there from Paris, he built a road just for himself and the queen and the family. And it was a very nice road and very beautiful, and had the soldiers and guards there at all times. So one would think, oh, there'll be no accidents. There's only one carriage, the king and the queen going back and forth to Versailles. There's not going to be no accidents. But sometimes there were accidents. Sometimes one beast would come out of the forest and cross the road, and the chariot might hit the beast, or the wheel may break and fall down, and you know, you bang your head and get a big cut or die. So there's the saying that accidents happen even on the royal road. So even in Krishna consciousness, where we're safer, in a safer position than the other transcendentalists, because we have God on our side. That's the beauty of devotional service. The yogi, the jnani are left to their own efforts to succeed, but we have Krishna. He's there, he's our protector. Protects the devotees at all stages. We have the Lord to assist us. Even then, it may be that there's some accident. We may become proud of the plumes. We may become these opulences. We may misuse them. Instead of using them in the Lord's service, we begin to use them in our own service. Nevertheless, if a devotee is sincere and demonstrates that his main interest is Krishna and Krishna's service, the Lord will offer some protection and bring a devotee back if he goes. There's a beautiful prayer I was reading. I often go on different God Brothers websites, and I particularly like the Facebook page of Mukunda Dutt, who's an unknown but an humble but very well versed God Brother, very good singer, a good friend of Giriraj Swami. That's how I met him. And he often posts these very beautiful verses. Like, I'll get the verse and then I'll post it on my Facebook and it looks like I found the verse. I even got a quote from Rani Priya's Facebook the other day and I used it. What was it, Rani? You're laughing at me because I'm different, and I'm laughing at all of you because you're all the same. I don't know where you got it. Maybe Niti Shastra or something. But these things can be used according to time, place, and circumstance. So one very beautiful verse I got from Mukunda Dutt: how the Lord will protect his devotee who may misuse the opulences and fall away. Very beautiful verse. O Madhava, Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, if a devotee completely in love with you sometimes falls from the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you will protect them. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. It's a beautiful verse. Why? Because the Lord is ever grateful for any service rendered to him. He's more inclined to accept the service than the offense. We shouldn't take advantage of that, especially with Lord Chaitanya, who is even more merciful than Krishna. He's even more merciful than Krishna. We've heard that when you go to India, you should first go to Mayapur Dham and get mercy before going to Vrindavan Dham. Because in Mayapur, that dham where Gauranga is worshipped, Lord Chaitanya, we hear he only accepts service, he doesn't accept offenses. Gornitai, they don't accept offenses, they only accept service. Of course, again, don't take advantage of that. But in Vrindavan, the service of Radha and Krishna is really exalted and done by the Paramahansas. So in that atmosphere, one has to be very careful and one can commit offenses and get the reaction. Whatever service you do in Vrindavan is magnified 1,000 times, and whatever offenses you make are also magnified 1,000 times. So some devotees prefer to live in Mayapur. So the idea is that the Lord is ever grateful. Just like a parent will naturally excuse the offenses of the child. Even if the kid commits murder, the mother's still going to the judge, "But he's a good boy, judge. Don't put him away for life. He's not that bad. He's a, what do you mean? He's a serial killer. But he's not really." It's the tendency of a mother to forgive like that. So the Lord is like that. And if we happen, if it, our real interest is in our heart of hearts is our conviction to serve Krishna. It's something else if one comes to devotional service and practices for some ulterior motive, is really not so interested, but just comes for some other reason, and just his heart is not really in devotional service. There's still strong tendencies to enjoy this world and so forth. That's maybe a little bit different. But if one is genuinely sincere, and the Lord knows your heart, he knows you better than you know you. If one is genuinely interested, yet genuinely wanting to serve, but due to some past conditioning or due to some bad association or some weakness, one temporarily falls away, in that case, the Lord will make the arrangement to bring his devotee back. And there's many examples. there's a whole slew of examples. Sometimes example is better than precept, or in the sense that it gives us faith. We have an example. There's the example of Yamunacharya. Yamunacharya, he's a South Indian Brahmana, very famous in the Sri Sampradaya. He was a great guru, actually, at the end of his life, and he lived at the same time as the famous saint Ramanujacharya. Ramanujacharya was younger, and Yamunacharya was older, but they never met. Just by whatever, some circumstance, they always wanted to meet each other. They were living even in the same proximity, within a few hundred miles of each other. But it's interesting how they never met. They met, eventually, at Yamunacharya's funeral. Although he had passed away, he gave some indication through his fingers moving of how Ramanujacharya should continue on with the mission of spreading Sri Vaishnavism in India. But that's another story. I won't tell that story today. We'll tell the story of Yamunacharya when he was a little boy. He was born in a Pukka Brahmin family, and he was a very good Brahmana, a very good scholar, devotee of the Lord. Actually, by the time he was 12, you could say he practically finished his studies. He knew the Bhagavad Gita by heart. It was his favorite. He used to sing the shlokas. It's like, you know, people have their favorite songs, so they put on their iPods and they listen to the, he would sing his shlokas as a young boy on the way to school, on the way home, as he was taking his shower. The Gita was his favorite. And when he was 12, he was finalizing his studies, and he had one teacher called Vashacharya. And because this teacher was teaching him academic knowledge flavored with devotion to Krishna, there was a very close relationship between Yamunacharya and Vashacharya. The teacher-student relationship was very close, but because he was giving something so precious, he had a special attachment for Vashacharya, special love. You don't see that in any universities or schools these days in general, like you would see in Vedic culture. A close relationship between the teacher and the student. Because this teacher was not only giving knowledge how to live in this world, he was giving knowledge how to get out of this world. The students were bright enough, the culture was such that these souls were very advanced. So there was some. So one time, a Digvijay, means a pundit who had defeated all other pundits, he came to the town. And of course, these Digvijays, they take great pleasure in just discussing and debating and defeating and getting more and more famous. They have a lot of knowledge. And whenever they would defeat someone, sometimes it was that the person who they defeated had to become their student. It was very humbling, very humiliating, to the point that sometimes, instead of becoming your student, because you defeated me, I'll kill myself. So this was going on. So he would defeat, and what he would ask for was, now you have to pay tax. Every year I have defeated you in philosophy. I have proved that my philosophy, my siddhanta, my understanding of the absolute truth is more than you. And because I have taken the trouble to defeat you and show that you're wrong, you must pay a tax every year. Yeah. So the Dignijai, he would go around, and part of his time he wasn't just defeating, he was collecting his tax. Remember I defeated you? What's your tax? Where's your tax? So he came to where Yamunacharya was studying with Vashvacharya. He came to that town to collect tax. He had his representatives go out and collect the tax. He said, yes, this Digvijay said, there's this Vashvacharya. He's a teacher at a local school. I defeated him one time, he told his student. Go and collect the tax from him. So the student went to the school, but Bhattacharya was not there that day. There was one lone boy staying back to study his notes, Yamunacharya. So this student of Bhattacharya came and he said, "I defeated your teacher in a debate. Where is he? I want my money. My teacher wants his money." And that student of the Digvijaya said, "Your teacher is such a fool, he couldn't defeat my teacher." And Yamunacharya said, "Actually, I can see that your teacher, the Digvijaya, he's not so powerful." "What do you mean he's not so powerful?" "Yes," Yamunacharya said, "I can see he's not very powerful because he's failed to remove pride from your heart." "Oh, what? Yes, how powerful could he be? You're a student, but you're full of pride. So how powerful is your guru?" It's often said you judge the guru by the quality of his disciples. So be kind to your guru. People will judge your guru by the disciples. So. So Yamunacharya, he said, "So you think that your teacher defeated my teacher? I don't think so. That was just my teacher's humility. He didn't want to debate with a rascal. I will challenge your teacher. I will debate with your teacher." So the student said, "But you're just a boy. You're only 12 years old. My teacher is a wise old man. How you can debate with him, you fool?" Yamunacharya said, "Go back to him. I'm ready to debate. Set the date and the place." The student was speechless. "I debate with my guru." And he got angry. He went back and he told the Digvijaya, "This is little boy. He wants to debate with you." So the Digvijaya, you know, he's maybe didn't have any engagement. He said, "All right, let him come. Let him come." And when the people heard this, they were very, we don't like this Vijaya. He's very puffed up. Students are very puffed up. He comes to the town and says, "Our Yamunacharya, he will defeat him." And the king and the queen, when they heard this, they were very impressed. The king said, "Yes, if this little boy, Yamunacharya, if he wins the debate, I will give him half my kingdom." So the moment, the day came and they assembled, and everybody with the king was there, the queen was there, the courtiers were there, the people were there. It was this huge audience. I don't know if they had sound systems in those days. I don't know how they did it. Somehow. So the Digvijaya was there. He was waiting, and then Yamunacharya came a little bit late, and then he walked in, and the Digvijaya said, "This boy is so small. How can he be a pundit? He's so small. He's only 12 years old. He's so small." Yamunacharya spoke up in front of everyone. He said, "Sir, the buffalo is bigger than you. Does that mean he's more of a scholar than you?" So the debate began, and the Digvijaya, thinking that this boy could know nothing, he wanted to reveal his ignorance. Because there's a saying that one can be thought of
wise until they open their mouth.
Yeah, one is thought to be wise until he opens his mouth. So you people are thinking that this Yamunacharya is a wise, so let him speak. You offer the first challenge, little boy. So Yamunacharya, he challenged the Digvijaya. He said, "Okay, you answer these three questions." He said, he said to him, "Your mother is barren without children. Prove that is wrong." So Pandit thought, "I was born from her. How can I prove that she's barren?" And he said, "Our king is pious. Prove that is wrong." "Prove the king? Say the king is impious?" And he said, Yamunacharya said, our queen is chaste. Prove that is wrong." "What? Prove that? You rascal little boy, you want me to prove that our king is not pious and to prove that our queen is not chaste?" and that your mother is barren? You're such a rascal. I'm not going to even comment. You answer your own questions. So Yamunacharya said, yes, your mother is barren. She's without children. Here I am, the pandit said. No. Your mother is barren without children because Manasanita says that a woman who has only one child is considered barren. She must have two or three to be considered not barren. Is that true or not true? And then you realize that there is a shloka like that in the Mahabharata, that a woman is considered barren with just one. She has to have two. And he was defeated. And Yamunacharya said, our king is impious. What? You'll have your head, the pandit said. No, he said, the king, if he's a good king, like our king, he has to accept 1/6 of the karma of the population. Now, it's to be understood that in a social body, there's pious and impious. So it means he gets 1/6 of the pious reactions of the people, and he gets 1/6 of the impious reactions of the people. So in that sense, the king is impious. The king is, this is Shastri. That's why we see in modern day, we see a lot of the leaders, they die violent deaths, they're assassinated. Because they've accepted, they've absorbed 1/6 of the population of millions and millions of people. And if your country is very sinful, like most countries are, uvaga, uvaga. We sing in Polish. Watch out. Now, the Digvijaya said, you say that our queen, I was to prove that our queen was impious. So how is the queen impious? So Yamunacharya, he said, well, in Vedic culture, a woman is considered chaste if she only has just her husband. She can't have association with other men. But the king is a representative of Agni, Vayu, Surya, Chandra, Yama, Kuvera, Vaya, Indra. In that sense, she's actually married to 8 demigods because she's married to her king who represents those personalities. So our queen is not just married to one man, she's married to many. In that sense, she's considered, you could consider it impious. Of course, it's a Vedic injunction. So in this way, the Digvijaya was defeated. And he lost that whole thing about, you know, everyone had to pay tax for him. There was a big cheer that went up from the crowd, and he just in shame, he went away. So the result was that the boy inherited half the kingdom. He's just a boy. He's learned, but he's just a boy. He's not grown up yet. He inherited half the kingdom. And as the story goes, as he grew up, he became a little forgetful of his Brahminical life. You know, king means surrounded by a lot of opportunities. You're a king. You have to divide and rule. You have to divide and conquer and rule over and use the treasury. And there's lots of courtiers, and there's the queen and the maid servants and the power and this everything went to his head. It went to his head. So gradually, Yamunacharya, although he was a very saintly person, because he became a king, he gave up all his spiritual practices. All of his spiritual, he just became a very powerful Raja, king. Kings are controlled by the mode of passion. And he just became disinterested altogether in spiritual life. So here's an example of being deviated by the opulences that one may acquire in the service of the Lord. For his service, he got half the kingdom. He could have used it so many ways. Opened up lots of namahatas and built a huge temple. But he got distracted. But Lord is very kind. He was a sincere devotee, and later to become a great acharya. So the Lord arranged that Yamunacharya's grandfather was always lamenting that this young boy had deviated from the path of devotion. So he was a spiritual master in his own right, and he sent one of his disciples called Ram Mishra to the palace with a particular plan, how to get back Yamunacharya. This Ram Mishra went out into the forest, and he collected a particularly powerful plant, a medicinal plant, which upon eating you become very healthy, and it easily cures many diseases, and it's very tasty. So he collected that plant from the forest, and every day he would go to the kitchen where the cook was preparing Yamunacharya, King Yamunacharya's meal, and he would give him this plant, and the cook would prepare it because it was rare, it was hard to find, but very tasty. He would prepare it for the king. So this went on for several months, and the king got really attached to that vegetable, to that sabji. So one day Ram Mishra didn't come, and the king, Yamunacharya, he asked the cook, where is my sabji? It's so tasty and I'm feeling so healthy. Where is it? And the cook said, I'm sorry, sir, it's a very rare plant. We just can't go out and find it. There's one sadhu who every day brings that plant to the kitchen for you, and he's not brought today. So several days went by, and the king became very upset. He called the cook. He said, well, if that sadhu comes back, I want to meet him. Tell him a thing or two. So the plan was that Ram Mishra came back one day with this spinach, this plant, medicinal plant, which tastes very good. And the cook said, hey, the king wants to meet you. He's very attached to you. This sub, and you haven't brought it for so many days. So immediately he had darshan with the king. Very hard to meet the king. But through this arrangement, he was able to meet the king. And the king said, why haven't you brought... Oh, sir, you know, it's hard to find, but I can give you something better than this spinach. You can? Yes, I know where there's a great treasure. I alone know what this great treasure is. It's the greatest treasure that our kingdom has ever known. And I can take you to it. Oh, the king said, yes. Better than the spinach? Yes, a very nice treasure. So the king said, prepare my army, we will all go together. And he said, no, just you and me will go. Because it's very difficult. This treasure is protected by seven walls. It's guarded by two rivers, a great serpent, and every 12 years a great demon goes to inspect the treasure. And it's also guarded by mantra. So only the two of us will be safe. If we go in incognito like this, we'll have a chance. So the king said, all right. So the next day, the king kind of disappeared incognito with Ram Mishra, and they went to find this treasure. His king was very greedy. Yamunacharya was very greedy for the treasure. And as they were going along, Ram Mishra began to sing verses from the Bhagavad Gita. Just walking along. Sarvadharmam paricchaya mamekam saranam vraja aham tam sarvapapebhyo muktasima sujitasim. Desham satare yuktanam. The king has long forgotten his Krishna consciousness, long forgotten all his memorized verses from the Bhagavad. He's hearing that, and Ram Mishra is singing day and they're walking a long way and singing day and night, and it had an effect on the heart of Yamunacharya. He started remembering his boyhood and his school and Vastacharya and his verses and everything. And then when he got to chapter 12, verse 8, the Acharyas say, Krishna says, just fix your mind on me, engage all your intelligence in me, thus you will live with me always without a doubt. That was the clincher. And Yamunacharya turned to Ram Mishra and he said, thank you so much. I had forgotten everything about Krishna consciousness, everything about devotional service. And just hearing the nectar of the Bhagavad Gita from your mouth, I again have a desire to be a devotee. In fact, I don't want to be a king anymore. I'm not interested in the treasure anymore. So Ram Mishra said, no, we'll go anyway and get the treasure for you. So where did they go? They went to Sri Rangam, and he gave him darshan of Ranganath. That was the treasure. Because Sri Rangam is protected by seven walls. You know, if you've been there, to seven walls around the city. There's two rivers on either side. Actually, it's an island. It's guarded by a great serpent, Anantashesha. And every 12 years, a great demon, Vibhishena, the brother of Ravana, who's actually a devotee, he comes to inspect the deity worship and make sure that it's all going on very nice. And it's protected by a mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva. Om Namo Narayanaya. Protected by mantra. So when he took him in to see the beautiful deity, if you've seen that deity, it's very beautiful. When I was there recently, he's very long deity. And when I was there, they were applying a special oil to his body to keep everything fresh. Actually, and therefore they only showed his head. I only got to see his head because the rest of his body was being covered by oil, was sitting soaked in oil, so you can't see it, so I only got to see his head. But one of the head priests took me to the side and said, "Don't be disappointed, I'll tell you a little secret, which I will now reveal to the world." He said, "Actually, our deity of Ranganath, we don't know what the core of the deity is. This deity is billions and billions of years old. Actually, the deity revealed himself to Lord Brahma on Brahma Lok and was eventually transferred down to the earth planet." There's a whole history that's told there. I don't have time for that now. But the deity was originally worshipped by Lord Brahma. And they don't know that the original core of the deity is made from gold or diamonds or rubies. They didn't want to say because they're always afraid that people will come and try to, you know, the Muslims are always coming and trying to invade and take the treasures from the temple. But they say the core of the deity is something amazing like that. He's a big deity. It may be a big diamond. But around that core, that precious core, is all thousands and thousands and thousands of shalagram shilas. They make up the shape of the deity. You know, the torso, the legs, the feet, the arms, the head. It's all shot so expertly arranged by the artisans, the Brahmin artisans, that it just, they put the shalagrams in their different sizes and shapes in such a way, perfectly forms a face. Perfectly, it's not, there's no bumps or anything. Perfectly forms the bangles that are naturally there on that deity, the rings, everything. It's a very beautiful deity, very fine. It's all shalagram shilas. And to keep it all together, put a kind of a thick, oily substance over the deity like that. Very thin film, which forms like a paste, kind of, a thick oily paste over the shalagram shilas like this to give the semblance of the final touches, the skin of the body. So deity is actually something in the core, I don't know, but mostly shalagram shilas, the thin paste, oily paste, so that's what they put on the deity. And it sits like that for 14 or 15 days or several times during the year. And I checked that story with my friend Murali Bhatta, who's one of the main priests in the temple. He said, "Yes, it's true. It's true." He said, "In fact, one time when I was a little boy, the priest came running to our house and asked my father for a shalagram shila because he had shalagram shila, very famous shalagram shilas from the time of Mahaprabhu. They asked him for a shalagram shila because during the night, the oily paste had cracked and one of the shalagram shilas had fallen out and they couldn't find it. So the Lord had a hole in his face. So in great ecstasy, he said, "My father," he took one of our household shalagrams and secretly went to the temple and placed it in the cheek and it fit perfectly by the divine will of the Lord and they covered it over. So every time I had darshan, I was thinking, wow, this is amazing. This deity is so beautiful. And very beautiful jewel eyes illuminating. So when Yamunacharya went there and he saw this, again, his devotional service. The Lord made an arrangement. Although he deviated, the Lord made an amazing arrangement and he came back on track. So this is there. The Lord will protect his devotee. If he goes, then some arrangement can be made. But better not to go. Better to stick with it through thick and thin. And how do we do that? there's less chance that one will ever leave if one is always in the association of devotees. Our strength is actually in our numbers. Many hands make small work. It's said that a Brahmin's strength is in his learning, a Vaishya's strength is in his opulence, a Sudra's strength is in his hands, and a Kshatriya's strength is in his army. So our strength, you could say, we're in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan army, we often say. So if we stick together with each other, we have hope. We're the marginal potency of the Lord, and we can be influenced either by the material or by the spiritual. So there's a lot of spiritual potency in the association of devotees. We do our sadhana together, and after our sadhana, we're marching in close formation down the streets of Melbourne as Lord Chaitanya's transcendental army, chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama. In this way, we're safe and sound. Prabhupada said he created this International Society for Krishna Consciousness for the purpose of association. So to the degree that we can stick in that association in its varieties of way, we are safe. But if that chance does come that we may deviate, but we're still sincere, you're out there, you can remember the story of Yamunacharya. The Lord makes the arrangements to bring his devotee back to his lotus feet. Gantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Go Premanandi.